week of October 28th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 169, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, literally inside Hurricane Sandy, I'm Michael Giltz.
Yes, once again, it is time for Showbiz Sandbox, a podcast where we kind of break down all of the entertainment news from the past week and tell it to our listeners. And I begged and pleaded with Michael not to participate in this week's podcast. I mean, I just thought he should be sandbagging, he should be building an ark, he should be helping people get off the streets in New York City. But no, he sent, you know, storm and all, he wanted to come and give us the news.
Our viewers are more important than my safety. There's rain, there's rising waters. I feel like Edward R. Murrow in The Blitz.
Okay, now do you want to explain what Blitz that is?
No, I don't.
Okay, so I would say Google Blitz. And in the meantime, I'll tell you what's on today's show. Because last week we told you which new television shows were doing well critically and in the ratings, as well as which ones might stick around for more than, say, a few episodes or, you know, go figure, possibly an entire season. On today's show, we'll be speaking to Scott Collins, a TV reporter for the Los Angeles Times. We're going to be talking to him about how DVRs are affecting the viewership and ratings of this season's new series. And if you thought this year's new crop of TV shows were in trouble, they've got nothing on the movies. If you were to believe folks like film critic David Denby in a recent New York Times piece, movies may not even be relevant anymore. After all, they're just, I don't know, 20th century, I guess is what you call them. Here in Hollywood, everybody's tongues are wagging about what's going on in the world of big-time talent agencies after the news that Jeff Berg is out at ICM Partners, and that's one of the town's top 10%eries, as they're called here in La La Land, Tinseltown, whatever you want to call it. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire and weatherman Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie at the box office around the world is Skyfall, the new James Bond film, which has opened in a lot of countries, doing terrific record-breaking business for the Bond franchise. In almost every territory that it's opened, it made $77 million around the world. It doesn't open here in North America for another 2 weeks.
Wait a second. So, it's opening right now. The sky is falling on you.
That's true. At number two around the world is Paranormal Activity 4. That grossed another $23 million. It's at $91 million and counting. At number three is Argo, which grossed $12 million. It's moved up to the number one slot in North America. It's been on the charts for 3 weekends. It's done well every weekend. And in its third weekend, it has moved up into number one thanks to soft releases by a lot of other movies. It has grossed $60 million. It's definitely having a good success story. At number four is The Bourne Legacy. Thanks to an opening in China, the latest film in that franchise made $11 million worldwide. It's at $250 million and counting. At number five, we have a two-way tie, including one of the big disappointments at North America. Two movies grossed $9 million each. They are Cloud Atlas and Hotel Transylvania, the animated film, which has now made $200 million to date. Cloud Atlas, of course, is the big, lavish independent film. It costs more than $100 million to make. It stars Tom Hanks, who appeared on seemingly every late-night talk show in one form or another. And there's no way to cut it. It's mixed reviews and weak box office.
Did you see Tom Hanks' appearance, I suppose, on Stephen Colbert's The Colbert Report, where he showed up to give advice on Halloween costumes, and all the Halloween costumes were characters of his from previous movies?
Yes, no, he was very funny, and he popped into Saturday Night Live. He popped in on other shows. It was sort of a stealth appearance, because in a lot of the shows, he wasn't the guest. But he just showed up to have some fun and so he could be on as many shows as possible, I guess. But that didn't help the movie. I read the book and I love the book. And every time I see the trailer or I see scenes from the movie, I just think, I don't want to see this movie. You know, I'm not that precious about books, but I really love the book. And I just think, that doesn't look right. I don't want that in my head because I love the book. And unless people loved it in the movie and thought it was terrific and raved, then I would be drawn to it and say, well, okay, I want to give it a shot. But given the fact that it just looks like it's not quite right to me, it feels a little off. It doesn't look like the way it should look to me. It feels like it's not going to be a success. I don't want that in my head. I don't want to mess with my memory of the book.
Well, you know, I think that your feelings here are actually apropos of what people are feeling about this movie. Cloud Atlas was a much beloved book.
Most people haven't read the book, obviously.
Well, correct, yes. But one would hope, and I think when the studio decided to make a $100 million movie, they're looking at a bestseller and saying, well, gee, even if, you know, the people, even if half the people go that purchase the book, you know, we can have a hit on our hands. Well, I think
if every single person who saw the book, you still wouldn't make my $9 million on opening weekend. They can't think that. It's not that it's not the Da Vinci Code.
Well, true. But don't you think that Warner Brothers, who made the film, don't you think that they are hoping that people who love the book will show up and through word of mouth spread the word on the movie? And I think a lot of people are saying, you know what, I love the book so much and the reviews are kind of middling to fair. I don't want to, you know what, I'll just leave that one alone.
No, I mean, it's nice to have that name recognition. They look at the book and think, this is a property that could make a good movie. By and large, they know they have to far exceed the audience for the book. I don't know how many copies it sold. It wasn't a big, massive bestseller. It was acclaimed.
Okay.
But if it sold 100,000 copies or 200,000 copies or what around the world, I don't know. But they certainly didn't sell a million copies, I doubt. So this is, you know, if it sold a million copies, which I don't think it did around the entire globe, well, that's a $7 million weekend. You know, then you're done. So then when they make a book, they know it has to reach a far bigger audience. It's nice to have that name recognition factor. It's nice to have a name brand author like Stephen King or John Grisham. But, you know, Cloud Atlas, they weren't expecting everyone in the book to, you know, obviously they want the fans of the book to see the movie and like it, but they know they have to appeal to a far bigger audience.
Well, now that was, I guess, a tie for what, fifth and sixth place? Those were the 5 and 6 movies.
That's right. And then at number 7 is a 3-way tie at $8 million. 3 different movies grossed $8 million. They are Madagascar 3, which is now at $711 million worldwide. The Liam Neeson film Taken 2, which is just under $300 million worldwide. And a debut in North America, a horror film called Silent Hill Revelation, which grossed $8 million. At number 10 is Frankenweenie. That made another $6 million worldwide. And then there's a 5-way tie at number 11 with a bunch of movies that made $5 million. They are the Kevin James comedy Here Comes the Boom, the Tyler Perry drama Alex Cross, Ted, the foul-mouthed teddy bear movie, and Asterisk and Obelix, that film we talked about last week that's opening in Europe, and Sinister, another horror film, that all of which made $5 million and are doing, you know, various stages of good at the box office, with Ted obviously being the really big blockbuster hit. The rest are so-so or okay.
And Ted is the foul-mouthed teddy bear movie, as you like to call it.
That's right. And of course, there were a couple notable flops in North America. Cloud Atlas did not open well. They can pray for suddenly some terrific word of mouth, but it's not going to happen. Also opening poorly was Chasing Mavericks, a surfing movie starring Gerard Butler that opened at $2 million outside of the top 10. And Fun Size, a smaller movie that grossed $4 million on its opening weekend. At least they were cheap. Chasing Mavericks and Fun Size were not expensive movies. Chasing Mavericks, I think, cost about $20 million to make. And is that right? Yes. And Fun Size cost about $14 million to make. So those were modest rolls of the dice. But even by that standard, they did not, you know, they did not bear out fruit. That's not what I want to say. What do I want to say? They did not play out. They did not, what do you call it when you roll the dice?
Craps. They did not pay
true.
Out.
They didn't succeed.
They didn't succeed. Okay. Well.
Right.
Well, do you think, I mean, Cloud Atlas was up in Toronto, and I don't know, I think that's where it premiered. And it didn't get, you know, really good response there.
It was polarizing. Some people absolutely loved it. Some people hated it. In general, it seemed that the people who had read the books were not fans of the movie. Some people, if they did like it, tended to be people who hadn't read the books. But even then, it was still pretty divisive. But I think the general tenor has proven more to be a noble failure seems to be about the nicest things people say for it. I should say, however, that our box office figures are very sketchy this week, not because of the hurricane, but just, you know, we are at the mercy of the industry. If people don't tell us what a movie makes, we have no way of finding out. And there's a lot of countries around the world where we don't get great numbers every week. We've told you this before. Our number one source is The Hollywood Reporter, because they have a solid weekly article where they sum up the foreign box office. But if they're not comprehensive, we're at a loss. We don't know what's going on. There's a couple movies. We don't have any info yet on Taken 2, which made $24 million last week. So it probably made a good amount of money this week. So our totals for that are just North America. Same thing with Hotel Transylvania. They must have made some money. Ted opened in India, but figures for India aren't out yet. So we're a little at a loss for that. So this weekend's coverage of foreign box office was notably sparse in The Hollywood Reporter. I even put a a comment at the bottom of the article asking for some information on some of the other movies. Not that they responded. They've got better things to do, of course. But, you know, we look at the LA Times, we look at Variety, we look at Hollywood Reporter, we look at industry sources that we can. But if they don't report it, we have no way of finding out how they've done. So,
and there's really no reason for us to be on the studio's call list every weekend to get both domestic and international grosses. And, you know, that's really probably what happened here is that the studios just didn't let some of these media outlets know the international grosses because they themselves didn't have them, or they were poor and didn't want to let them out. But that's exactly how Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profits, The Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, the New York Times.
But they all know what the North American box office is, period. They don't cover, most of them don't cover the foreign box office.
That's right. That's right. Well, that's true. So Box Office Mojo.
They can't hide the figures of North America.
No, no, not at all.
Right. So the problem is most people don't care about foreign box office, which is silly. And we're just at, you know, if the studio mentions a gross, then we have to depend on someone to report it to us. Because sometimes they may have told the grosses about Taken 2. And Hollywood Reporter may just not have gotten around to including it in their article because it's not a comprehensive list of every country or anything like that. It's just a roundup of the biggest information. So, you know, we got to depend on them and other outlets, and they just didn't pass on the info or it wasn't available.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, does it really matter? Does any of it really matter whether Cloud Atlas was a hit or a miss or whether we have foreign box office or not? It depends on where you are. Foreign to us here in the United States, but not necessarily if you're in the UK, then foreign is the US. So does any of it really matter?
Well, I know you're leading this into an article by the New York Times talking about, are movies relevant anymore or do they matter to the culture? And the answer, of course, surely is not anywhere near they did in the way they did in the 1970s.
Right. I mean, if you look at Cloud Atlas, that was during, you know, there was a time where a book like Cloud Atlas shortlisted for the Booker Prize, if I'm not mistaken. There was a time where that would have been setting the tone in the culture. You know, everybody would have been talking about
it. No, a bad movie does not set the tone in the culture.
I'm talking about the book. I'm not talking about the movie.
The book.
The book. That's right. Now, because if you follow my line of thinking here, you know, there was a time where books did that, where they kind of were, you know, they set the tone in the culture. And there was a time where movies did that. And I don't think, and I think the New York Times is saying the same thing, that movies do that as much anymore.
No, of course not. Radio dominated, and then Broadway dominated, and then movies dominated, and then television dominated. Then movies came back again in the 70s. You had the 60s and 70s with foreign films and the Maverick movement in American cinema with Coppola and Scorsese and all those people. And then, it moves again. I think, television is really where it's at right now artistically. You know, that's where all the great work is being done. That's what people talk about. That's what they get excited about. You know, the cycle will turn. Things can come back into vogue, I think. You know, movies were huge in the 30s and 40s, and I think they became huge again in the 70s. Broadway will never come back. Broadway will never be at the center of culture the way it was for a period, where songs on Broadway hit the radio, where Broadway shows were what people talked about and cared about, and they sort of set the tenor of the times. That era will never return. Radio will never dominate the way it once did in the popular imagination. Television today is where it's at. Can movies ever quite dominate the way they did in the 70s? Obviously, it's a question of opinion, but I doubt it.
Well, you know, here's the thing. I was at Universal Studios Hollywood over the weekend, and now granted, they happen to have these Halloween Horror Nights over there, which is a big success. But there were posters and advertisements and promotions for The Walking Dead everywhere, not just inside Universal Studios, but all over Universal City Walk. And I mean, think about it. That's what a lot of people are referencing these days.
That's the biggest hit on TV. And it's a huge hit. And frankly, it's fun. The season has been really good, I think.
Yeah, I mean, think about it this way. Homeland, Mad Men, Walking Dead. What's another TV show that's a...
Boss, Breaking Bad, Archer, countless other shows.
Right. So these are all shows that you hear about, whether it's through the media or through friends. And I think that you don't hear the same thing about movies anymore. Maybe Twilight, maybe The Hunger Games, but you don't hear about Argo. Certainly, I mean, sure, it's on South Park and they're kind of making fun of it on South Park, but do you...
And it's a potential front runner for the Oscar.
Right. I mean, the other time that I can remember a movie being talked about this way was The Social Network or Avatar.
Right. Individual movies, of course, can break through, but as a whole, movies are just not as dominant. That's the article by Michael Seipley in the New York Times They conflate two issues. One is the artistic importance of movies and how they impact culture. And the other one is the business and how the business is doing. They talk about some of the problems the industry faces. Movie attendance in 2011 was the lowest since 1995. Only 1.2 billion tickets were sold. Revenue from DVD and Blu-ray is falling. And of course, TV is where it's at. So what is Hollywood doing about it? What are the steps that they're taking to try and seem cool and hip and relevant?
Well, they got Daniel Tosh to host the Oscars. I mean, Seth MacFarlane of, you know.
They might as well have gotten Daniel Tosh, frankly. He's a bigger hit on Comedy Central than Jon Stewart.
Well, exactly. And, you know, he, for those of you outside the country, is a comedian that hosts a television show that features web videos on Comedy Central. Instead, they get Seth MacFarlane of TV's Family Guy. He will be hosting the Oscars. And of course, his biggest contribution to the world of filmmaking is Ted, which he directed, and he is the voice for the foul-mouthed teddy bear in Ted.
That's right. And that's a big hit. That's the biggest R-rated comedy of all time. So that's no small potatoes. It's only one film, but he has had a big debut into the industry.
Right. Now, I guess Michael Seipel in the New York Times also pointed out that the Academy is building a museum to movies in California.
Because that's going to help make it cool again.
Well, I don't think it's a museum to movies. I think it's a museum to the Academy. I think that's really what it's a kind of an Academy museum is what they're building.
Oh, okay.
So I don't necessarily know that it's just for movies. You know, obviously it's for movies, but it's really about their history. And they're trying to figure out, the Academy that is, how they're going to present, you know, the Academy Awards. And they thought, well, maybe get some directors of Best Picture winners. They could get together and you know, start talking about how cool movies are. And they could put that in theaters to promote the Oscars and movie going.
Those strike me as wildly desperate. Seth MacFarlane, we're building a museum. Maybe we'll do a short film and put it in movie theaters where people are already there to watch a movie.
Well, no. Wildly desperate would be like getting, I don't know, off the top of my head, like a politician to talk about, you know, how important movie going is to the culture and to the country. Oh, wait,
right.
I think
they wanted Bill Clinton to advise them on award shows and the Oscars. That was one idea being brooded about in the industry. What if we got Bill and Hillary to talk to us about how to make movies relevant? That's sort of through the looking glass time, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that.
The basic plea of some people is, well, start making relevant movies again. They say don't ignore that mid-range movie because Hollywood wants to make $4 million horror films or $200 million superhero blockbusters. But what they want to ignore are movies like Argo and, frankly, movies like Cloud Atlas, which was not made by Warner Brothers. It was an independent film that got its financing together from, you know, different sources around the world. That was made independently by and large. Warner Brothers is distributed in North America, but that's very much an independent film because no studio wanted to roll the dice on it.
But don't you think, I mean, looking at the 70s, because, you know, just taking the 70s.
It's the heyday.
The big heyday of the independent film and independent, but the auteur theory.
It's more the heyday of the studios embracing an independent spirit. We had people making independent type films for the major studios. The era of the independents was 1990s with Miramax and all that.
Yes, okay. So what Michael said, wouldn't you say that during that time period of the 1970s, you actually had filmmakers who were doing it out of passion, that they actually had something to say, and it wasn't just a quote-unquote product to them. It was a statement. It was art. They really believed that, you know, they really looked at themselves as much of an artist as a painter or as an author. And I think today with Viacom owning Paramount and Comcast owning Universal, that it's just become a big corporate product making machine, and that none of these films are really, there is no passion in them.
Malarkey.
You don't think so?
Absolutely not.
So where are the films with passion? Let's look at like the Avengers.
Well, I don't think the Dardenne brothers and the Coen brothers and Wes Anderson and Steven Soderbergh and 1,000 other filmmakers that I could name are just providing corporate profit. The problem is not that there aren't filmmakers making good movies. The problem is that its era has passed and movies just aren't where it's at anymore. There's still great authors. There's still great shows on Broadway. There are still talented directors making passionate movies that they care about. It's just that overall, the time has passed for the industry. It's not the dominant source of pop culture for the moment.
Do you think that people could be welcomed back or would welcome movies back into their lives and movie going back into their lives if those particular filmmakers that you mentioned, Steven Soderbergh, of course, an argument could be made that he does he straddles both lines. He makes very commercial movies like Ocean's 11 and the whole Ocean's 11 series. And he also does some really independent movies like Magic Mike.
So does Francis Ford Coppola.
Well,
in the 70s. I mean, they were making big hits. It wasn't that they made tiny films for, you know, tiny audiences. They made big hits. That's not the problem. Movies are a big business, as I've said many times. It's doing well. DVD and Blu-ray are slowing, but streaming and digital copies are growing. Attendance was down last year, but if you look at over the past 30 years, the trend lines, attendance at movies is very, very solid. It's been growing every year.
Keeping pace with the population. As a business, I agree with you. You know, let's not talk about that for a second. Let's talk about cultural tone and mind share. And I guess I'm looking at The Avengers, and yes, it's got a mind share for like pre-adolescent teens, but where is The Conversation, which was a movie directed by Francis Coppola, or The Godfather? Where are those films? The ones where you can actually, and yes, I realize that The Godfather was a big studio movie, but it was also, you know, it advanced the art form.
Yeah, there are still great movies being made. That's the whole point. The whole problem with this debate was not that there are only bad movies being made, which was the hint of what they were talking about. I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson made The Master. That's a serious work of art. It could have been made in the 70s. It's very Stanley Kubrickian. That's not the problem. The problem is that you can't make something matter to society as a whole. There are great Broadway shows being made. It will never be the center of the universe again. Movies, I think, have more of a shot because they're so big and they do capture the imagination. Perhaps the wheel will turn and movies could become more dominant again in the culture. But I think essentially you look at there's so many more opportunities to make so much more art on television with hundreds of channels. You know, you've got 400 TV shows a year. You've only got 400 movies in a year. You've got so many TV shows, you've got 400 channels. Forget how many TV shows there are. You've got 1,000 channels on cable. We've only got about 400 major studio films a year, 300 to 400. About 700 to 800 movies are released a year in New York City, period. And that includes every tiny little documentary film playing for 1 week at Anthology Archives. It's about 700 to 800 total. Major studio films are obviously much fewer than that. You've only got a couple times at bat. You're not going to do as well as the people who get to go to bat every day. There's 1,000 channels, and they're all producing programming. So television dominates for the very simple reason that you get to create a lot more work right now. You get a lot more chances, and you can survive with a smaller audience. You don't have to have a big out-of-the-park hit. So the economics favor television. Mad Men has dominated the culture for several years. It's not a hit.
Yeah, no, that is true.
2 million people watch the show.
2 million, yeah. Well, you know, there's
Walking
so much.
Dead is a hit.
There's so much television on right now. And as you say, 1,000 different channels. I mean, there's just, it's almost, and it's free. So a lot of it is free. Yes, there's HBO. Yes, there's Showtime. But most of it.
You haven't seen my cable bill.
Well, okay. Besides the cable bill, yes, I agree with you. And I know I'm going to hear from listeners about how it's not free because of cable. But for the most part, it's, you know, we're not being asked. Well, we are being asked to pay. A lot of it is free. Okay, that's what I'm going to say. There's not a huge paywall like there is with movies where you have to go to the movie theater or buy the DVD or rent it. You know, there's so much television, in fact, that there are times where there's like 3 or 4 shows on at the same time that I can't watch all at the same time. So I have to like break out my DVR and, you know, record some of these shows to watch later.
And that brings us to television and DVRs. I mean, obviously, we have a story from
the Los Angeles Times
about that very issue.
Well, that's right. Major networks used to bemoan the DVR because they feared, and correctly so, that audiences would use it to skip over commercials. I mean, Michael, who would want to do that? Who wouldn't, you know, why would we skip over commercials? I mean, anyway, people did the same thing with VCRs, but DVRs made it so much easier. And boy, isn't that the truth. Now, DVRs are in almost half of all households in the U.S., and networks aren't just making do. They're touting the big increases some of their shows get after factoring in the DVR audience. This was explained by Los Angeles Times staff writer Scott Collins in a recent story he published. It ends with a quote from one advertising consultant that reads, "Who cares when they watch?" Now, we're going to be doing a little time shifting of our own as we, you know, record content for later viewing and or listening. In this case, we're going to cut away to a conversation that I had with Scott Collins about his piece in the Los Angeles Times on the importance of adding DVR viewership to ratings numbers for the current crop of television shows. So we'll cut away to the conversation with Scott and then come right back to do Big Deal or Big Whoop. Scott, I'd like to thank you for joining us or at least myself, to talk about, how DVRs are affecting television ratings. You wrote a story in the Los Angeles Times earlier in October, and you kind of mentioned that at this point, there's the Nielsen ratings, which are overnight ratings, and there's this kind of DVR rating that gets added to the Nielsen ratings, and that's making a huge impact.
Right. There are actually several rounds of ratings that come through from Nielsen that affect television ratings overall. And one of the main readings that we see from Nielsen is what is known as live plus same day. In other words, that's everyone who watched a program when it was first telecast or watched within the same day up until midnight. Then there are other Nielsen ratings that measure, people who may have watched up to 3 days after the original telecast. And then there are ratings for people who watched within a week of the airing. So we actually now have about 4 or 5 rounds of ratings that come through that the networks are busy interpreting and spinning.
You know, so there's live plus 3, live same day, and live plus 7, and of course there's live. But I guess even with all of those figures coming in, and maybe it's because all of those figures coming in, this may perhaps have been one of the more interesting facts in your article, is that no one really knows quite sure how many people are watching any of their shows. And you quote Dan Harrison of Fox, he's saying that next morning ratings are increasingly problematic. And he goes on to talk about how Nielsen can take days or even weeks to tally up complete numbers for a single show. How can they run a business? How can these networks run a business and sell ads against their shows without knowing the number of people who are actually watching them?
Well, they do know the number of people who are watching them. They just don't know overnight like they used to. It used to be that decisions could be made pretty much on an overnight basis, but the DVR has done away with that. What they do know, or at least the Nielsen statistics purport tell them, is within a 3-day period, they know how not just how many people watched a certain program, but how many DVR users watched and did not skip through the commercials. Because as we both know, that's one of the things that a lot of DVR users do, is they skip through the commercials and then just watch the program. So the so-called C3 ratings tell you, or purport to tell you, how many people watched the entire program, including the commercials. They do have those, but it just takes several days to get them.
So it's live same day, and live plus 3, but not live plus 7. And that's what advertisers are caring about, is they don't care about live plus 7. They care about the live plus 3, but only if the viewer didn't skip the commercial.
Right. And that's what the L3s and C3s, I think, are actually different, because the C3 ratings show people who watched everything, including the commercials. The L3s don't necessarily show who watched the commercials. It's just about the program.
Well, and I guess if they, well, let's say you're watching a show, and you may not know this, but if you're watching a show and you skip one ad block but not the next, do you get, is it a per ad kind of payment, or is it that granular, or do you have to, is it the entire show? Like if you skip any part of the entire show, the whole show's out.
To tell you the truth, that's an interesting question, and I'm not sure what the answer to that is, because there are a lot of people who skip certain ads but not another. And I know in my own watching, there may be a movie preview that looks interesting, and so if I see it kind of flashing past on a DVR as I fast forward, I'll go, I want to see this. There's this new Lincoln movie coming out, and I want to see the entire trailer for it. So I'll back up and watch the whole thing. And I think a lot of people do that. But I don't know, to answer your question, what exactly the C3 measurement entails. I just know that there is a broad agreement among advertisers that they will accept those. They will not accept the L7. There's a good reason for that, in that, if you watch a commercial 6 days after the original telecast, that doesn't necessarily do the advertiser any good, especially if they were trying to sell you a movie. They want, you know, the reason the studio bought the time is that they wanted you to show up the opening weekend. If you show up the second weekend, it doesn't do them as much good.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually just now finishing Lost. I know I'm a few years behind, but it's very interesting to see what was being advertised 2 or 3 years ago in the month of May and what movies were opening then. It's been on my DVR for that long, and I thought, well, I should probably get through these.
You certainly didn't get swept up in the rush, let's put it that way.
Yeah, of course, now I know what happened, but that's a whole other
right.
story. Well, now, you know, these DVR kind of ratings, these, well, I guess I'm a little confused now. It's L3, C3, whatever the DVR ratings are. Can those ratings save a show? Because for NBC's Revolution, you point out that the premiere got a 40% bump when you added in DVR watchers.
It's an interesting question whether it can save a show. I tend to think that it can prolong the life of a show. I guess sometimes for better or for worse. But I mean, I think that the DVR numbers were certainly network executives list them as a factor in saying, hey, you know, we're giving this show a full season order, even though the live ratings aren't exactly where we want them to be. The DVR numbers are very good. And they've been saying this for a while, but I think we're seeing it increasingly, you know, where they're looking at shows and really what we're talking about are scripted shows, because sports and
live events,
sports and reality shows, many of them are not live, but they sometimes often have live components to them. But in either case, the lift that they get from the DVR numbers is negligible. I mean, we're really talking about scripted shows, and that's really what video on demand is becoming. It's becoming about scripted stuff. So, I mean, I think clearly when you look at some of these shows and you're seeing 10, 15, 20, 25%, 30% increases for some of these shows, yeah, that makes a huge difference. Now, I will say this, what one of the network scheduling people said to me was that it's a rich get richer phenomenon, which is not, you know, unusual. I mean, it applies in economics, it applies in network science and many other disciplines. So in other words, television shows that have high ratings tend to do very well in the DVR numbers. And television shows that don't have very high live ratings don't tend to generate very nice numbers when you look at L3 or L7 ratings. So you take a show like ABC's Modern Family, which is a huge hit. It's a hit even when you look at the live numbers, but when you throw in the DVR numbers, it just becomes enormous. So I mean that's a show that once you add the DVR numbers, you know, that rivals some of the old hits of the past that people are saying we never see anymore. I mean, millions of people are watching that show. You know, the numbers can be really huge. And I think even when you look at a show like Community, when you look at a show like, you know, Up All Night, those are NBC shows that don't generate big numbers, but there is a justification to keep renewing them when you look at the DVR numbers, because you can say, well, okay, the live ratings aren't very impressive, but once you add in those DVR numbers, we can kind of see that there is at least a loyal fan base here, even if it isn't a huge one, and therefore it's justified to keep bringing the show back.
Well, it's interesting that it used to be that networks would kind of hide these DVR usage figures, but now they've somehow started touting them. How long has that really been going on, where they're touting these DVR numbers as proof of success to advertisers?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if they've been hiding them, but they just haven't been foregrounding them, really, I think, until this fall. I mean, this year is really the first year where I started seeing, you know, a lot of mention about the DVR numbers that wasn't there in the past, and a lot of promotion of these numbers. Hey, you know, look at our DVR numbers. They're so great for this show that, you know, seems so unimpressive when you look at the first round of ratings. And I think it part of it is simply that this fall, there has been very, very little for the networks to brag about other than, you know, football. Football continues to do really well. But when you get beyond that, there's not really that much to talk about. If you can point to the DVR numbers and you can say, you know, the audience looks a lot better once you throw these stats in there, it gives the networks a real compelling reason to do it. And so I think a lot of it is just as simple as that. Also, there's been a real tipping point with reached with DVR usage, because, you know, a few years back, we were only talking about, in 2006, I think it was like 1% of U.S. homes had a digital video recorder. And now we're talking, it's like in the 45, 48% range. So, I mean, you're talking about very soon, probably this year or very early next year, it's going to be more than half of U.S. households are going to have access to the DVR. People are really using them. I mean, they're now often part of their set-top boxes, and they're very easy to use. So the combination of those two things have made people use the devices. And even if they just do that for a show or two a week, it makes a huge difference in the ratings, especially, as I say, for these shows that are already generating big numbers, but increasingly, you know, a quarter of the fan base is saying, I want to delay the watching of it.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like, in a way, possibly, it could be kind of a net win for viewership, that because people are able to time shift certain shows, that more people are watching more television. It's just that they're watching more television across a scattered number of stations instead of or networks instead of ABC, CBS, and NBC here in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of it has to do with the fragmentation, which really we continue to see. I mean, even though I think a lot of the growth in new cable and satellite networks has slowed from where it was, let's say, 10 years ago, when it seemed like we were every week having a new cable network, we're not getting so much of that, but I think there are a lot of demands on especially younger viewers' time, so that younger viewers, younger adults are spending more time on Facebook, they're spending more time on Netflix, BuzzFeed, various other destinations online, they're spending more time with their smartphones, you know, their Samsung Galaxies and their iPhones, and they're not really spending very much time in front of the flat screen, and if they are, they're watching something on DVR, or they're hooking up their laptop to the TV, you know, through an HDMI cable and watching the programming that way.
Well, let me ask you about that then, because I wonder, is there anybody out there who knows how many times the pilot of Revolution, which you mentioned in your piece on the LA Times or at the LA Times, does anybody know how many times it was viewed by adding up the premiere numbers and all the DVR viewing and then iTunes downloads, maybe viewings on the NBC's website, Hulu, and wherever it could be watched? Does anybody actually compile all those numbers?
No, not that I know of. And I've talked with the network research people about this. I mean, there isn't any single source where you can, you know, I mean, Nielsen is working on this, and various other research providers, Rentrek is one that is trying to get a better handle on the data. But no, there isn't any one source that tells you all the people who watched on television or DVR and all the people who watched on a digital platform. You know, that means everyone who watched on a smartphone, everyone who watched on iTunes, everyone. I mean, no, there is no such thing that does that. It's kind of the holy grail, because, I mean, in essence, we're talking about pioneer territory here. And what everyone wants is a snapshot of the aggregate audience.
Right.
But the new media are developing so fast. I mean, think about it. I mean, a few years ago, smartphones didn't even exist. And now every crosswalk in every U.S. city is filled with people who aren't even paying attention to traffic, and they're just looking down at their phones.
I have no idea what you're talking. I would never.
Right. Right. People are tripping over fire hydrants because they're so busy looking at their apps or their widgets on their phones. So that has happened very quickly, and it has outpaced the ability of statistics people, even armed with very powerful computers and statistics theory. People have not been able to keep up with the development of new platforms, and there are just too many of them too rapidly. So, I mean, I think it's going to take a while before there's a reliable aggregate number that says this is a workable estimate. Because when we're talking about estimates here, it's not a measurement like SoundScan. I mean, SoundScan.
It measures the sale of music.
Measures the sale of recorded music, and every time it's kind of moot now to talk about point of sale swiping, but I mean that's what SoundScan did back in the day. I mean, every time a Garth Brooks CD was swiped across at the register at the record store or Walmart or wherever you bought it. Actually, I'm not sure that Walmart was participating in SoundScan, but wherever a SoundScan retailer was participating, it was swiped, and the code was read, and then it went into the SoundScan database. So it was an absolute measurement. It wasn't an estimate. It wasn't like the Billboard rankings or Nielsen's, which are estimates that are extrapolated from samples. SoundScan was an absolute, and I don't think we're going to get to absolute data anytime soon that would say, this isn't from a sample, because we don't even have that in television right now.
That's right. Yeah.
We're dealing with estimates. I think in the opinion of most people, although not all people, the estimates have proven to be fairly reliable and consistent over the years. So you don't get a lot of things that seem like grotesque abnormalities or things that just don't make any sense whatsoever.
Well, you mentioned that technology is moving so fast that all of these measurement systems can't keep up with gathering these statistics. I would almost argue similarly that the technology is moving so fast and the cultural shift is moving so fast in the way people watch television and the media that they consume that the network's business models can't keep up.
Yeah, one would think so, although they seem to figure out ways to stay in business. There are a lot of things going on there. I mean, that's kind of a complicated question, but I mean, I think overall, they have found ways to deal with the media fragmentation we've been talking about and the lower viewership totals by, in some cases, cutting budgets, cutting the number of episodes that they make. You're like, oh, well, how is AMC producing not just Mad Men, but also The Walking Dead and Breaking Bad? I mean, these aren't cheap shows. And they're not cheap shows, but you have to remember, you take something like AMC, that's a cable network, so it's making money not just off the advertising that they sell, but they're making money off subscriber fees. Those shows are not part of a 22-hour or 15-hour a week primetime schedule they have to put together. They may only make three or four shows at a time. That's much different than what a broadcast network has to do.
And then they'll play them again and again and again.
They'll run them again and again and again, and also those shows give them, a huge platform to work off of, and a great marketing opportunity that really, I mean, AMC a few years back was just a place where you went to watch old movies, and they even showed commercials during the old movies, and now it's got the cachet of a premium network like HBO or Showtime just because they've made these very highly acclaimed few original series. So, I mean, it's totally you know, reconstituted and rehabilitated that network and remade it into something completely new and completely different. And I think most people would say much better than what it used to be.
I know. I would say that with the hundreds of channels, there almost seems to be a bit of a golden age for TV right now as far as quality is concerned.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, there were years when people, when they talked about the golden age of television, and this is especially true. I mean, maybe we just hit a trough in like the 1970s and 1980s, but I think especially the 1970s. The 1970s, I think, in television were a period that a lot of people liked to beat on at the time, and they still do some beating on it. But
what, with the Love Boat and the $6 Million Man, how could you hate that time period?
Yeah, exactly. I think people like to talk about the first age of commercial television, the end of the 1950s. I Love Lucy is kind of the golden age of television, Sid Caesar. And then it seemed like we went through another golden age in the 1980s when Stephen Bochco and Hill Street Blues and St. Elsewhere, shows like that, kind of reformulated the network one-hour drama. And then now I hear people again talk about the golden age of television and Downton Abbey and Walking Dead and Mad Men. I mean, for every era you can find shows that people remember and shows that influence what other people do on television. It's just that right now there's an awful lot of programming. I mean, I don't know if it's a golden age necessarily compared to the other ages, but what it is definitely is a highly productive age just because there's so many networks and they're all producing original programming.
Well, the one thing I guess I'll leave us with is that I'm always, whenever I'm fast forwarding through the commercials, I'm always struck by the fact that when I'm not fast forwarding through the commercials, I'm checking email or I might be on one of those devices mentioned earlier, like an iPhone or a Samsung Galaxy, and I'm not paying attention to the commercials at all. But when I am fast forwarding, I am watching the screen and I'm paying attention to when the commercials end, and I'm actually registering which commercials are being shown. So in a way, I'm paying more attention by fast forwarding through the commercials than if I just kind of ignored them until the show came back.
One of the interesting things about what DVRs have done to commercials is changing the way that commercials are cut. Because when you fast forward through a commercial, you're just getting like screen grabs of the commercial. But when the screen grabs look pretty interesting, you're really tempted to stop. Part of it is just kind of making the commercial visually interesting, which they've been trying to do since the advent of commercial television in the late 1940s. But I mean, now it's getting pretty sophisticated, and I've noticed that even in a lot of the movie trailers that are running on as network ads, they are trying to put lots of different images in there. And they don't even really care. I mean, sometimes the movie ads make almost no sense. when you watch them live, they're almost nonsensical. You're like, what the hell is this movie about? But I almost think that sometimes it's being cut for a DVR because they know that a lot of people are fast forwarding, and the point is to almost like throw open a hard drive of all these different images and hope that at least, one or two of them will be enough to make people say, oh, wait, back up. What's this? And so it's almost like it doesn't matter if the movie ad makes any sense or tells you what the movie's about, which is what historically movie ads have tried to do, is say, oh, you like Jennifer Aniston, you'll like this movie because she's in it and she plays a woman who's trying to find love in the city. Now it's almost like here's some really visually interesting stuff that hopefully will get you to stop hitting the fast forward button on your DVR remote and get you to back up and watch the whole thing.
Well, Scott Collins, a television reporter for the Los Angeles Times, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today. And I know we're going to be linking to your story in the show notes, but is there a Twitter handle we should be promoting here?
Yeah, it's at Scott Collins LIT.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I greatly appreciate it.
Great. Thanks a lot.
That was really great of Scott Collins from the Los Angeles Times to discuss with us why DVR viewing is so important now to this season's new television shows. But I know, Michael, you wanted to join us, but due to the storm, you were without power. So, but you know, and we're running long, so I'm just going to move right along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story? Well, I know this is one that Michael has a lot to say about. It's about Random House and Penguin. These are two multinational companies behind two of the biggest publishing houses in the world, and they have agreed to merge those publishing divisions. If approval comes from the EU and government officials in the US, which, let's face it, after the EMI Universal thing, it's going to happen, by the end of 2013, Random House and Penguin will become one sole company called Penguin Random House. Although I think it should be called Random House of Penguins. That's just me. The German company Bertelsmann will own 53%, and the UK company Pearson will own 47%. That means the big six publishers in the US will now be the big five, with the combined Penguin Random House, or as I like to say, Random House of Penguins, though they will control 25% of the North American publishing market. News Corp tried to turn this whole thing, this merger, into a bidding war with a last-minute $1.6 billion all-cash bid. But they had no luck with that. Big deal or big whoop, Michael? Or can we just move on to the next one because we know this is a big deal?
It's definitely a big deal. My gosh. It has a huge impact for the industry. Everybody thinks the big six would have merged into the big five or the big four because Amazon is the big one. And they can't stand up to Amazon. Amazon pulled down every book from one publisher when they got into a spat over, you know, rates and contracts and agreements. Well, now, when they're facing off against Random House of Penguins, can they really pull down one out of every four books?
Wait a second. Did you just say Random House of Penguins?
I did. I'm embracing it. I like it.
Okay.
So now you have a counterweight to Amazon. That's one argument for why this is necessary. I don't agree, but that's one argument for the benefit that could come out of this merger, that Amazon won't be able to push them around anymore. So now maybe they can go mano a mano a little bit. But for authors, this is disheartening news.
Well, I think for consumers, it's disheartening news. I mean, let's face it. Fewer choices of companies producing a product mean that prices could potentially rise and we'll have fewer offerings.
Well, you know, there's 300,000 books a year, 3 million if you count self-published. There are thousands of independent publishers. It's never been easier to publish independently. To set up, you know, we talked about that Barry Diller company where they set up a publishing house from scratch, you know, within an hour and a little bit of funding. So the level to enter the business is much easier than it's been before. There's very little barriers. So there's a lot of turmoil and change in the industry. I wouldn't worry about that too much for consumers. I think consumers are doing great.
Okay.
But authors, you know, this isn't going to mean that there's one less house that they can turn to. This means there's about 100 less houses because Random House and Penguin both had lots of imprints, individual sort of sub companies that would bid and search out authors to match whatever their priorities were, like mystery or literary fiction or whatever it might be, or just the taste of that particular editor in charge of that imprint. Now, of course, there's going to be a lot fewer of those because they're going to merge. So the mystery division at Penguin and the mystery division at Random House will undoubtedly merge and become one place. That means fewer jobs in the industry, fewer places for authors and agents to take their books. You know, it's of concern. Plus, of course, there's that Department of Justice lawsuit. Penguin was taking the Department of Justice to court, fighting them over that big lawsuit about whether they colluded to lower prices of ebooks. Well, now that they want the merger, of course, they'll probably say, hey, we'll drop the lawsuit if you let us merge.
That's right.
So it's going to have a big long-term impact. It's fascinating.
Yes. So big deal.
Absolutely.
Well, then let's move on, because in a story about President Obama appearing on Jay Leno in the late night talk show, The Tonight Show, we got a quick glimpse into how late night is faring. Remember, soon, Jimmy Kimmel will be moving up to 11:30 p.m. on ABC, and Nightline, which is now on at 11:30 p.m., will be moving back to 12:30 a.m., so they should call it next dayline, maybe. You know, and this is happening even though Nightline is sometimes the number one show in its time slot, beating out Leno, beating out David Letterman's show, Late Night, and beating out Stephen Colbert's The Colbert Report. Why move a hit TV show? Is it because Kimmel draws the kids? Apparently not. At least according to this snapshot rating, Nightline's rating, was 3.2, with Kimmel a 1.6, meaning that Kimmel held only 50% of Nightline's audience. So 50% of Nightline's audience were held onto by Jimmy Kimmel. What about the key 18 to 49-year-old demographic? There, Nightline drew a 1.1 and Kimmel drew a 0.6, again, almost 50% lower. So they're dumping one show, and that's Nightline, with twice the audience and twice the key demographics for another show that is half as popular. Good luck with that. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. Jimmy Kimmel actually was headed to New York. He had shows scheduled for tonight in Brooklyn. It was Jimmy Kimmel Live in Brooklyn. It was sort of a homecoming.
From Michael's apartment, living room.
No, Brooklyn. I'm in Queens. I'm in Long Island City, Queens. And they were still talking yesterday about how they were going to hold the shows. And they were going to have safety. It was like bizarre. Like, people, you can't have your show. Nobody can get to your show. There are no subways, trains, buses, or cars. How will the audience get to your show? So today they finally said, yeah, I guess we're going to cancel Monday night's show. So they finally came to their senses. But to me, it just seems like a bad business decision. They just feel like it's Kimmel's time. Same thing with Conan. You know, they dumped Leno for Conan because they thought, well, gosh, you know, we got to give him a shot. No, you don't. It's a business.
So you're saying that ABC is making emotional decisions, not necessarily business decisions.
Yes, I do think that. I do think they would argue, well, we think he can compete at 11:30. He'll draw a bigger audience. More young people will check him out. He's at his peak. He's really coming to his own. I'm like, well, the numbers don't back you up.
Well, let me play the contrarian or the devil's advocate. I don't know which word or phrase is appropriate. What would you say to people, possibly an ABC programming executive, who says, we don't expect any show after Nightline to hold on to 100% of Nightline's audience, because some people, they're just there for the news. They want the news. It's a news program. And then afterwards, they have no interest in Jimmy Kimmel. And we know that. We knew that going into it.
That would be a lot more telling if the Nightline demos in 18 to 49 weren't strong. If Kimmel was holding on to the key demo of young people, you'd have an argument. You could say, all right, you don't expect a lot of 18 to 49-year-olds to watch Nightline and then watch Kimmel. They're not watching Nightline. They're watching Leno and Letterman. Yeah, but they're not switching over to watch Kimmel at 12:30. And Craig Ferguson and Jimmy Fallon have the same problem. They don't hold on to their lead-in. They don't have 100% of their lead-in. But they're compatible and they work well. Nightline is not a natural segue into Jimmy Kimmel. I'll grant you that. But I don't see the numbers that Jimmy Kimmel is showing signs of life and is so promising that I want to dump a profitable venture. That also, by the way, comes from the news division, where you're always looking to make money. It's hard to make money from the news division these days. ABC doesn't have a 24-hour news channel, so they have their big news operation, and one of the few areas where they're making money other than Good Morning America is Nightline. And they're going to move it into prime time Friday nights, I think, at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock. But still, I think it's not a smart business decision.
Well, I time will tell. I think you mentioned that Craig Ferguson and Jimmy Kimmel not holding on to their lead-ins. Let's face it, they're on at 12:30 in the morning.
I'm just saying nobody holds 100%. Almost no show ever does.
Right. Okay.
They are successful. They have good flow. They hold on to enough of their lead-in that they're competitive. And Craig Ferguson is the best late-night talk show host in the country.
I really like Craig Ferguson. But let me ask you this. Do you think, because last week and the week before that, President Obama, President of the United States, everywhere, all these late night talk show hosts or talk shows, and he does pretty well on them. But Mitt Romney, totally not around at all. And I'm thinking, well, will that hurt him? Avoiding all of these late night shows, is that going to hurt him in the upcoming presidential election?
Well, I think it's not so much that it might hurt him, but it didn't help himself. He could only help himself by appearing on Jon Stewart. Jon Stewart was not going to attack him. Or, you know, he was going to be polite and treat him with deference, as he often does, especially with big guests. You know, that was going to be a place where he'd be asked some questions, but he could show himself a good sport. Everybody would tune in. He would not be, hammered. There's no way Jon Stewart would do that. We haven't seen him do that with anyone in a long time. Even if he asked a tough question, it wouldn't be a question Mitt Romney couldn't answer, and it would be asked in a polite way. I think he lost an opportunity to show a more human side, to reach out to young people, which, Obama, that's his demographic. So why not go after that audience? I don't see the point of not going on Letterman or Jon Stewart. They're going to, treat you very politely. It's not like Letterman having Donald Trump on where he can mock him. You know, he's going to give Mitt Romney his due. He wants him on the show. He's going to treat him respectfully. The guy's running for president. There's no reason to think he would be sandbagged. And I think it is a missed opportunity.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. And I think it would be probably the most watched especially before the election.
Exactly, more than even Obama. Of course, Obama got big ratings for Letterman, as did Michelle's appearance. Obama had big ratings on Jon Stewart. I think Mitt Romney would have drawn even bigger ratings. I agree with you completely.
Now, was Obama on Letterman or Leno? He was on Leno.
He was on Leno, but he's on Letterman as well, I believe. I know Michelle was. I thought he was on Letterman as well at some point. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, who knows?
I'm sure. I know he's been on Letterman.
Yes.
So, yeah, I know he's been on. I think he went on both of them.
Well, let's move on to Amy Winehouse, because she, get this, is back on stage.
In a hologram?
Well, you know, I guess it depends on how you define on stage, because, you know, not really. It's not the real Amy Winehouse. And no, I don't mean a hologram. But a play about her life and the pressures of fame is set for next year in Copenhagen. It will draw on the public record, including interviews, acceptance speeches, letters, concerts, and so on, not to mention her songs. Winehouse died at the age of 27 last year, and oddly, given the access to her lyrics and other material, her family says it has nothing to do with the production. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop unless it gets really good reviews. It's by the Danish Royal Theater, so it's not some, you know, low-rent nobody. This was an interesting project. I understand the public record is available. I'm not quite sure how they got access to the songs. I don't know whether they're singing them or just quoting lyrics from them or what. But if they are, then I assume the family has to be involved. They have to at least give their permission, unless the copyright is not owned by the estate of Amy Winehouse. So I'm a little confused by it. But it's a big whoop unless it gets good reviews.
Well, I think, you know, I don't know if they're singing them. I think actually they are kind of reading them out like poetry.
Okay.
You know, they tried to make me go to rehab, but I said, no, no, no.
Okay.
No. Okay. Well, maybe we needed who does those interpretive readings?
William Shatner.
Yes, that's who we needed. Thank you.
They wanted me to go to rehab, but I said, no, no, no.
Yes, I've been back, but when I come back, you'll know, no, no. Okay.
Well, at least we amused ourselves.
That's true, because God knows we're not amusing anybody else. This next story, I almost...
not amusing at all.
Not amusing at all, and I just... thinking about it makes me feel dirty. A child sexual abuse scandal swirling around a beloved TV icon in the UK is sending shockwaves throughout the BBC and the entertainment industry overseas. The late Jimmy Savile, who was sort of the UK's Dick Clark, the host of the landmark TV series Top of the Pops for decades, among, you know, a number of other shows. After his death in October of 2011, some shows were preparing year-end tributes, while other shows were investigating Savile's long-rumored misconduct of the highest order. One BBC show canceled its expose of Savile, but ITV ran a story this month, and the story exploded. Was there a cover-up at the BBC? That's one issue. With some witnesses initially coming forward, the police have now been swamped by 300 people and counting who say they were sexually molested by Savile, who did lots of charity work for kids, of course, and rather oddly had offices or quote-unquote rooms for his private use at various medical facilities. Now we hear his preying on underage children, almost exclusively all girls, was an open secret. Police arrested and questioned Gary Glitter in connection to the case. Glitter, who was released on bail, is the pop star notorious for owning child pornography and the rape of two little girls in Vietnam. He most certainly won't be the last arrest made. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a very big deal. It's hard to imagine the equivalent in the U.S. Gary Sandusky obviously comes to mind.
You mean Jerry Sandusky?
Jerry Sandusky. But that's a guy most people didn't know, and it was more about the famous boss that he had than him. If his boss had done it, then they would be getting closer to how seismic this is in the UK. It's a huge story. There's one bizarre thing. Was this guru, this PR guru, was quoted in The Guardian, one of the UK newspapers, and he said that more than a dozen celebrities from the 60s and 70s were, quote, frightened to death that they could be implicated in the Savile abuse scandal.
What?
And this Max Clifford, this guru, this PR guru, said he didn't name any stars, but he said they had approached him to handle any possible fallout because they didn't want to be associated with it in any way. He says at the peak of their careers, they spent time with young girls, but, quote, never asked for anybody's birth certificate, he said. To which I say, is this the worst PR guru ever? has he been detained by the police yet? I mean, That's unbelievable. Like, how could you call him a PR guru when he's that much of an idiot?
Well, you know, he's a PR guru of in his own mind, maybe.
I guess. By the way, I think it was poor wording on my part. We should say that Gary Glitter was jailed in Vietnam for molesting two young girls. I'm not sure in Vietnam what the difference is between molesting and rape or what their laws are, but it was officially molestation, I believe, to clarify that. Well, but they were 10 years old and 11 years old. He was in jail for 4 years, and I had no idea he'd moved back to the UK, but there you go. He's on the child sex offender registry, and he was going to fight it, he claimed, but then he gave that up and said, well, never mind, I'm being an idiot, I'm going to be on it for the rest of my life. And now, of course, he's been arrested for this case because that ITV story included a tale of a woman who says she witnessed him having sex with an underage girl while Jimmy Savile was molesting another girl next to him. So it's just as ugly a sort of tale as you could ask for.
And it stretches all the way to the CEO of the New York Times. So we won't get into that. But
of the New York Times?
Yes.
How so?
Oh, I knew I shouldn't have said anything. You know what? I don't know.
All right.
But
all right. Good heavens. Well, yes, certainly the head of the BBC is being questioned. There's multiple internal inquiries. I guess we shouldn't be shocked anymore. It seems all areas of society, people look the other way when people are committing evil. Well, you know, it's an open secret that he was, I don't know what they would have said at the time, naughty, or what was the nicest way they could put this. But it's just shocking that people, it's not shocking that somebody would be molested and be afraid to come forward, because we see how poorly they're treated when they do come forward. These people came forward and gave their stories to the BBC. Then they saw the BBC squash the story. One of the people in the BBC who has come forward in the inquiry said, guys, you can't do this. It's going to come out. They've all spoken on the record. This news of this story is going to come out. Even if we don't air it, you need to air it or it's going to look like a cover up. And of course, that's exactly what happened.
Well, and for those of you overseas who may not know who Jerry Sandusky is, he was an assistant football coach, American football coach, who worked for a university, Penn State, and he was implicated.
The assistant to the beloved Joe Paterno.
Right.
Who, one of the most famous football coaches of all time.
Right. And convicted.
And football is the national religion.
That's right. Convicted of molesting at least 10 young boys.
Yes.
So that's what the reference was. But let's move on, please, to Barnes & Noble, who is diving into the UK market, speaking of overseas. And no, they're not expanding their superstores into London, because that would be foolish. They're starting to sell the popular Nook e-reader at bookstores and supermarkets throughout the country. They've also opened up an online Nook store with millions of e-books available for purchase. Big deal or big whoop? I want to go with big deal on this.
You're right, Sperling. It's a big, big deal. It's unbelievable. For years now, maybe Barnes & Noble would have thought about entering the UK market. You know, 20 years ago, they might have done it, competing with Foyles and some of the other superstores that they have in the UK, stores that are sort of modeled after what, not modeled after, but do the same thing that Barnes & Noble's and Borders did in the US. But now they've entered the UK market in one fell swoop without opening a single store. They've opened an online store. They're selling their e-reader devices in bookstores that they partnered with. And with supermarkets and elsewhere, those bookstores will now partner with them and use them to drive sales to the Nook and get a piece of that sale. But people can also go right to the Barnes & Noble Nook store and buy the books right there. And Barnes & Noble will be the number one provider and get all the profits that they can out of it. Basically, they've entered a huge foreign territory without having to build any infrastructure or ship a single book overseas.
It's almost like there's a whole new economy. Let's call it, I don't know, what's a good word for that? Like a digital economy. Oh, wait.
Right. So if you're wondering if bookstores are going to survive in North America the way they are today, this is a clear answer as you can get. All those guys have a new competitor on the block, and they didn't have to spend anywhere near the money that the others do. Can Barnes & Noble survive as superstores around the country in America? They just can't. It's not going to happen.
Well, look, obviously Bruce Springsteen and U2 can play anywhere in the world and draw a huge crowd. Much
Bruce.
Like... you know, it's kind of like when we show up to do a, you know, a live podcast, you know,
absolutely
huge crowds. But, you know, for smaller acts, touring is both their biggest form of revenue and a financial roll of the dice. A three-year-old website called Songkick acts as a go-between for artists and their fans. In the case of Andrew Bird, it encouraged fans in Latin America to commit to buying a ticket to one of his shows if he came to their town. When enough fans sign on, Bird commits to the city on his tour. The fans get to see a favorite act, and Songkick, of course, handles all the backroom stuff for a small fee. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop.
Really?
Yes, I think Kickstarter makes sense for different projects. I think all sorts of things make sense. I think reaching out to fans and saying, hey, we're thinking of touring Latin America, guys. You're my Facebook fans. What city should we play in? Everybody vote. That makes sense. But letting another company step in and take a cut out of the one profitable area left for musicians, which is live touring, because you can't figure out what city to play in, seems stupid to me. There's a lot of ways to test the demand for your act to go play in a market, whether it's Madrid or Barcelona or down in Sao Paulo or you know, in Brazil or whatever, Latin America, South America, Spain. I don't think you need
this
company.
You do realize that, but both.
I'm terrible with geography.
Spain, nowhere near Latin America.
I'm terrible with geography. I just don't think Songkick offers enough of a need. Unless it's too hard for you to set up and deal with local, you know, then you've still got to go to local places and book gigs and have a place to play, and they're going to want to sell tickets. To me, I just, you know, really, you can't figure out what cities to play in? You know, it just, to me, it makes no sense. You're just letting another company get a cut.
This is a whole marketing play. That's all this is. It's marketing.
Right, but you don't need Songkick to do it.
Well, maybe they have a turnkey solution, and they actually have launched this service called Detour. And, you know, there's another service called Gig Funder, and they work by letting fans place advance orders for tickets, and then the act can decide, okay, there's enough advance orders to go play a specific city. That I get. It's kind of it's a marketing ploy, and all the fans kind of try and get all their friends to buy enough tickets to have the act show up. That I get. It's a marketing ploy.
I understand how it's supposed to work. I still don't understand giving Detour a cut of your ticket profits in touring. That's the one area you're making money. Why do you want to put them in the middle?
Well, because somebody's going to be in the middle. Either it's Ticketmaster or this group. Somebody will be in the middle.
No, but you still have to go to a venue. You still have to book with a venue. They're going to want to sell some tickets too. You're not going to sell every ticket. So you've got them taking a cut. You've got the venue taking a cut. It's just another person dipping into your pocket.
Everybody's hands are in your pocket.
That's right. By the way, we should do a live podcast. What a great idea.
Yeah. Okay.
No, yeah, we'll get fans in the audience. You know, it'll be just like Garrison Keillor touring the country with Prairie Home Companion. I think it's a great idea. Maybe we'll do Town Hall in New York and you pick a venue in LA and we'll just bring all our fans out to watch the show.
My living room. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Fonda Theater.
All right.
The San Francisco Giants enjoyed a fairy tale ending last night as they swept the Detroit Tigers and won the World Series with 4 straight wins.
Yay! Since the Detroit Tigers beat the Yankees, I'm glad they lost to the Giants.
Well, I guess it's great news for them, but not so great for the TV network Fox. To make money and spark interest, they really need a Game 6 and a Game 7. I don't think they're going to get it. I really don't. Instead, Sunday's final game of the World Series was beaten in the ratings by just a regular old football game on NBC. In fact, the World Series was also topped by the ratings for football on Fox from the afternoon that bled into primetime. Football overruns on Fox scored an 18 rating and then a 19 rating for the postgame. The World Series dropped by almost 50% and scored only a 10 rating, leaving the San Francisco Giants and the Detroit Tigers feeling a little bit like Jimmy Kimmel. Guess America's pastime has more to do with blocks and tackles than strikes and balls. Big deal or big what, Michael?
It's a big deal. I mean, the World Series can't deliver. Why they were able to double, I mean, more credit to baseball and its commissioners and its teams for doubling the amount of money that was paid for baseball when their ratings continued to drop. I don't know how they did it, but they did it.
You know, yeah, that's
a regular
true.
Game on the afternoon draws more than the final game of the World Series. And yet they get to keep raising their price. They doubled their price. It's amazing. But why do people, I don't watch football, why did people tune in after the game was over? They literally, the game was on, then it ended, more people tuned in, and then as soon as, it wasn't because they wanted to see the World Series, because as soon as that started, they turned it off again. So they said, I really want to see the post-games coverage. Really?
I have no idea. That's a good question. Maybe it was at a time when people were home again and could turn on their, I don't know.
All right.
Maybe they wanted to see, you know, in the post game, they kind of do a rundown of all the other games that day, and it's Sunday, and they're going to go over all the other games that were played in the league.
Well, they do. They do, absolutely.
So maybe that's why.
All right.
Okay, well, let's move on to Warner Brothers, because they tried to push Redbox, you know, that company behind all those kiosks at grocery stores and drug stores here in the United States that have all the DVDs. They tried to push Redbox into waiting 2 months before it could start renting movies to customers. Netflix agreed to a delay, but Redbox just ignored Warner Brothers entirely and purchased the movies at traditional retailers when they went on sale, and then just began renting them through the kiosks like always. So Warner Brothers agreed to keep the one-month window Redbox had been enjoying, apparently with an increased fee. And Netflix can, of course, get the same deal if it chooses or stick with the two-month window. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's a success for this one company against a big corporation. So that's good. People who like Redbox are certainly happy. But it just points to the massive confusion for consumers. I mean, how does anyone have any idea when a movie is available? I mean, it's got to be so confusing if you really care. Some movies are available for digital download before DVDs go on sale. Others are available to rent 1 month after DVDs go on sale. And still other movies are available 2 months later. And still other movies are available on video on demand even before the movie opens in theaters. I mean, it's almost impossible to figure out what's available where and when. And studios should really try and be as consistent as possible and be available in as many ways as possible so that people, you know, can just not have to worry or wonder about when and where a DVD might be on sale. Oh, can I buy a digital copy but not a DVD? Can I rent it but not stream it? You know, whatever. It's confusing.
I completely agree. And I think this is precisely one of the major issues facing the home video market now. And, you know, Redbox, to do this deal, Warner Brothers said, okay, but we want you to promote the Ultraviolet digital download initiative that we have going on. Warner Brothers is a huge backer of Ultraviolet. I don't know how Redbox is going to promote that or why it's in their best interest to promote it. Because
it's not, but they're being forced to do it.
Right. How are they going to promote? Well, I guess really the way they're going to be forced to promote it is, gee, on the DVDs you sell us at an inflated price, we'll have these commercials on them before the movie starts for Ultraviolet. That's the way they will help promote it.
Thanks for renting this DVD, you sucker. Why aren't you downloading it via Ultraviolet?
Right, exactly. But that kind of wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. I'm not so sure that the shakeup in the 10%ery business really affects our listeners this week, but certainly it does have the entertainment industry talking.
And 10%eries refer to agents.
That's right, talent agencies. So
what's the difference between an actor or a talent person will often have a lawyer, a manager, and an agent? Who does what?
Okay, so the lawyer is reviewing the contracts and kind of making sure that everything is, you know, when a contract is negotiated, that it all makes legal sense and is above board. And, you know, that way the agent, who is really just kind of the negotiator for the contract and kind of negotiates the big deal points, then it gets put into a contract that it has all this legalese that gets given to the lawyer. So the agent is representing the talent, be it a writer, director, actor, producer. Sometimes a company and a production company is representing those entities to producers and production companies and studios and negotiating their deals.
Don't managers do that? Don't managers get business? I don't understand the difference between an agent and a manager.
Technically, they're not allowed to. Managers are not allowed to go out legally in the state of California, and I think even New York, they're not allowed to go out and solicit work.
So what do they do?
They are there to manage the entire career of the
how
talent.
Well, how do they manage it if they can't help them decide what work to get?
Well, that's what they're doing. They're reading the scripts. They're trying to find scripts for them to maybe produce.
But they can't go talk to anyone about it.
Well, they can if they're a producer, because then they are seeking work for themselves as well. So a manager can actually produce content.
Are most managers producers of their clients' content? No. Manager is not producing all his movies.
Many are, believe it or not. Many are producing their clients' movies, especially
if
their
clients
are
five people in a movie, there'd be 500 producers listed.
Have you ever seen a modern
There's not that many producers.
Right. Well, a lot of them are, like Gavin Pallone, who used to be an agent and is now a manager. He does a lot of producing of his clients' work.
So managers solicit work by pretending to be producers.
Well, I think that's...
And agents solicit work by what? What do they do? They just sit back and wait for the offers to roll in?
Well, no. I mean, what do they do? There's a long, you know, that can be a bit complicated, but the reality
is... My client wants $10 million to make that movie.
Right. And they know where all the bodies are buried. They know which films are a go at the studio. They know which ones are casting. They know which... They're the ones dealing with writers and sending the writer's screenplay onto the studios and the production companies, trying to get them purchased.
So there's the ones who can solicit business.
Right, precisely.
Agents can go to Warner Brothers and say, hey, why aren't you putting Tom Hanks in that movie?
Or, hey, here's a brand new script from my writer client. Don't you want to buy it and turn it into a movie? And when you do, in fact, here's a young director that can direct it. And hey, once you get that director signed on, is it a go picture? Because if it is, I've got four different actors that can star in the lead role.
So legally, agents beat the bushes and create business. Managers help the client decide what offers to accept, where to take their career, what to do with it, and the day-to-day lives that they deal with. And lawyers make sure all the contracts are legal.
Right. Now, why are we talking about all of this? Last week, one of, I guess there's a number of different big agencies. Creative Artists Agency is probably the biggest and definitely is the biggest. ICM Partners is in there, along with William Morris Endeavor. Used to be the William Morris Agency and Endeavor. They joined forces a couple years back. And then there's United Talent Agency, UTA, and a number of others. But ICM Partners is one of the top three, and their chairman for decades has been Jeff Berg. However, Jeff Berg and a private equity firm owned ICM, International Creative Management, for the last several years. They sold out to management either earlier this year or late last year. And when they did that, they basically formed ICM Partners, so that ICM turned into ICM Partners. And in doing so, they created kind of a group of agents that were running the business. There wasn't just one head. Jeff Berg.
It was a socialist collective.
That's right. And Jeff
Berg.
They're
communists over at ICM, is what you're saying.
Well, I don't necessarily know that they're communists, but Jeff Berg was the head of the, and I say that they're not obviously not communists, but but Jeff Berg was the head of the business since, I think, 1985 or maybe even 1979. I don't remember when he took over. 79, I think. But he was kind of told, look, you're no longer the head. You're just one of us. And oh, by the way, you're not really even a partner. So
he wasn't a partner either?
Oh, I don't know. That I should take back. I don't know whether he was a partner or not, but he was no longer the head. He was no longer an owner-operator, that's for sure.
So last May, ICM sort of went private. It wasn't on the stock market, but it was owned by this private equity firm and the management. The guys in charge bought that company out and took control of the company again. And they said, we're not going to have a boss. We're just going to have a sort of a horizontal structure. So Peter Berg, who was the head of the
Jeff
company.
Berg.
Jeff Berg. Who Peter Berg is the director. Jeff Berg was the head of the company, but his guys came together, bought the company back, and put everybody on a sort of a level playing field. So suddenly he went from being the boss to, at best, one of the guys. So the writing was on the wall. And now, after decades in charge of this company, he has stepped down and is forming his own new company.
Right. Well, and really, this news leaked out slowly on a Friday afternoon. And when that happens, you kind of know something is up. Like, it's not being done late on a Friday afternoon because it's pleasant news. And so Jeff Berg announced he was leaving the agency. Then it was kind of made public that maybe he was ousted. Well, no, not really. I mean, he's going to stick around for a little while. I mean, he used to be one of the most powerful men in Hollywood, along with people like Mike Ovitz and Jim Wyatt and Ari Emanuel and Arnold Rifkin.
I think Michael Ovitz now oversees a couple Chipotle chains, doesn't he? Isn't that what he does now?
I'm not touching that one with a 10-foot pole. But yeah, I think that's exactly what he does.
If you're scared of me, Michael Ovitz, talk to my lawyer or my agent or my manager, if you can find them.
So he realized, you know, his days there were kind of coming to an end. And he said, I'm going to go out and raise some money. And this is Jeff Berg. I'm going to go out and raise some money and start a whole brand new, whether it's an agency or a management firm, but we're going to start representing people in some form in all areas, film, television, Broadway, commercials, you name it.
Because that's what he does. He's done it for decades. He's 65 years old. He's not that old. He's rich, I'm sure.
Oh, yes.
But hey, what's he going to do with himself? He's going to do what he always does, and now he wants to be his boss again.
That's right. And so he's...
The end of an era.
I guess, you know, the folks over at ICM Partners kind of found out that he had raised all this money to go off and start another venture. And they said, listen, we're going to ask you to not come in on Monday.
But we knew he was going to go anyway. I mean, once he went from being the boss to just one of the guys, there was no way he was going to stay there forever.
Right, exactly.
You can't go from running things to suddenly like, oh, do you want coffee? You know, that's no fun. But he's not the only one to leave ICM. Who's going with him?
Well, yeah, and I don't know whether Carol Bodie, who was a kind of a veteran agent, and she was at ICM as well. I don't know necessarily that she's going with Jeff Berg, but certainly the writing was on the wall for her as well, because when the partners were formed over there at ICM Partners, she was not one of them, despite being a longtime veteran agent. And, you know, I guess she represents John Hamm now, but over the years has represented everybody from Kim Cattrall to Mick Jagger to Shirley MacLaine.
And Haley Steinfeld, the girl from True Grit.
Yes.
Are there any women in that top tier?
Oh, I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are. And I probably should have looked this up before we started.
Well, if you're sure, that's comforting to know that it's not just that there are only men.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure if I were to look it up that there are actual...
So this is all fallout from the fact that they bought the company back. They bought the company back. He was no longer the boss. She wasn't offered a position as partner. But it is a sign of change in the talent agency world. Other than the fact that they took control, what does this say about the industry?
Well, I know the talent agents and agencies for some time have wanted to, at least in the United States, to be able to do exactly what managers do, which is to not only solicit work, but also be able to produce content, whether it be a movie or a television show.
But that's a huge conflict of interest.
Huge conflict of interest, and therefore they are kind of banned from doing that and barred
from
doing
that. And what is the conflict of interest?
Well, because if you are negotiating as a producer, you have to produce the content.
You want your artist cheap.
Right, exactly. And guess what? You're representing your artist. So if you're representing Tom Cruise and you have to pay for Tom Cruise, you basically want to pay Tom Cruise as little as possible, and yet you're representing him. So it's a huge conflict of interest.
But that's the law of the land. Okay, so they'd like that to end, but there's no sign it's going to end anytime soon.
No, not at all.
So what does that have to do with all these changes at ICM?
Well, I mean, I think that for years, the industry was run by the Mike Ovitzes of the world. And these are all senior veteran agents from the
70s. Berg, Michael Ovitz.
Yeah, Jim Wyatt. And they're being kind of taken over by the Ari Emanuel. So this other generation of a younger generation, not from the 70s and 80s, but more from the late 90s and the 2000s, who are saying, hey, it's our turn now.
Okay, so it's a changing of the guard.
Right, and the question is, with this changing of the guard, will the talent agencies kind of begin to swap places? Will ICM Partners be the number one talent agency over CAA? I highly doubt it. Will there be a whole bunch of shifts in who represents who? Certainly, if you were to look at what Bill Cosby did last week, that's really not a sign.
Everything ends. Everything comes to an end.
Right, and you mentioned Bill Cosby. The reason I mentioned that is because he was represented by Norman Brokaw over at the William Morris Agency for 48 years, the better part of 50 years, the majority of 50 years.
He started with him when Bill Cosby broke into TV on I Spy and became a lead actor in a drama, which was very unusual for a black man. And he won three Emmys in a row for that show. So he was a groundbreaking actor, and Norman's been with him since those early days.
Right. And you know, William Morris Agency, when I was there in the mid-90s, the rumor had it that the only reason that William Morris was still able to survive was because of the royalties coming back and the payments coming back from the Cosby Show.
Now, because they packaged that show.
Right. And I think that was very overstated. I don't think that that's entirely true. But certainly William Morris was a distant third in the agenting business and was making a lot of money off of The Cosby Show, which had been off the air for at least 4 years.
Right, but it was in syndication. It was one of the biggest hits of all time.
That's right.
It turned around an entire network. It brought them a ton of business. But there you go. So, yeah, so they benefited unfairly. How dare they benefit from a big hit? It's like saying, what studio did Avatar? Universal? Who did Avatar?
20th Century Fox.
Oh, Fox. You're like, oh, Fox wouldn't be doing so well if it wasn't for Avatar. Well, okay.
Yeah.
So he had a long-term friendship with Norman Brokaw, and now he's left WMA. Is Norman Brokaw retired? We think so. Is that the idea?
Yes, I believe he is retired, and WMA is now WME, William Morris Endeavor, after merging with Endeavor. And
so Bill Cosby has not dumped his agent of 48 years. It's that he needed a new agent, from what we can tell, and he's left WME and signed with CAA.
Right, precisely.
Is it a big get?
Not really. No, because Bill Cosby, he does maybe 100 dates a year. So yeah, they'll get some bookings out of it. But all of the work that you'll get, recurring revenue from, like The Cosby Show, that all still belongs to William Morris Endeavor. So it's more of a symbolic victory for Creative Artists Agency.
So guys can run the industry for 30 years like Mike Ovitz and Jeff Berg, but the Young Turks one day are going to push them aside. And you can have the most fruitful and beneficial partnership for decades, but eventually one of you is going to retire and you'll have to move on and find someone new, even after 48 years. That's a hell of a run.
Yeah, well, and it's funny that you should use the phrase Young Turks, because when Michael Ovitz was running Creative Artists Agency before he left to be the president of Disney for a year, there was a group of five agents there that were known as the Young Turks.
There you go.
But in any case, that's kind of, you want to talk about inside baseball. That's about as inside as you can get.
But what I want to talk about is listener email.
Well, it's funny you should mention listener email, because we do have a listener email from, well, Mary Parker. I don't know if I'm supposed to say her last name, but maybe I should just say Mary. So she sent us
too
an
late,
email.
I think.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right about that. Do you want to read this? You want me to read it?
I want you to read it.
Okay. Well, she writes here, "Hey, Sperling and Michael, love the show! Exclamation point. I am amazed at how the show is both comprehensive and in-depth. You are all I need in entertainment news.
I love Mary Parker.
When I got this email, when we got this, I was just like, oh my God, this is the best email ever. She writes, I'm a 30-year-old woman, right smack in the middle of their coveted demo, and I noticed for the first time this fall, I am recording only one broadcast TV show.
Which one? Is it Revenge? Is it The Good Wife? Those are my two guesses.
All my other favorite shows are on cable or premium. Why not broadcast? It's mostly a time issue, actually. Between books, movies, video games, and this little thing that she writes here called, what is this? Life, actually. It's life. I only have about 6 hours a week devoted to TV. If the show is not, quote unquote, amazing, and she writes that in capital letters, then I am just not interested. Mediocre shows used to make the cut, but not anymore. And then she writes, trend alert. I have recently found that I am watching dramas from South Korea. I am American-born and not of Asian heritage, so this does not seem like something I would be into. But these dramas are endlessly entertaining. I don't know how men would respond to these shows, but I find myself recommending these to girlfriends all the time. A word of advice to broadcast TV. Try an American remake of a Korean drama. Now, it's going to take some guts. Korean dramas are on for one season. I think a drama that lasted for one, maybe two American TV seasons that had a beginning, middle, and end would be refreshing. I know it goes against our culture of finding a hit and milking it for all it's worth until it's a husk of a thing, but if broadcast could get a show that had solid serial storytelling and good acting, I would be excited. Signed, Mary."
Well, Mary, thanks a lot for writing. There's a lot to get into here. I'm watching virtually no broadcast TV as far as primetime dramas and sitcoms. I'm sampling a few, but all my really shows I'm committed to are on cable because they're better. But you only have 6 hours a week devoted to TV. You're way behind the curve as far as America's concerned. I think it's about 3 hours a day that most people watch television. So you clearly are spending more time reading books and movies and video games. So that's cool to see.
I hope she's not reading video games, because if she's reading video games and playing books, that would be a bad thing.
It would be bad. As far as South Korea, as I think we've mentioned before, you're right. South Korea is very influential throughout Asia. Their TV shows are the popular TV shows in Asia. K-pop dominates the market all around Asia, not just in South Korea. Japan, China, everybody listens to K-pop and they watch South Korean TV shows. They are where it's at right now. And of course, this idea of a show running for one season, that's a telenovela, you know, as they know it in Latin America. It's sort of a season-long miniseries. You have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Just like Mary says, a beginning, middle, and end.
Right, and they've been around for decades in Latin America and obviously in South Korea, but they've never caught on in North America. We have miniseries, of course, but as far as creating a show that was designed to last just one season, the expense and amount to put it on keeps them from wanting to do that. They say it's too much bother. If you can't have it run for multiple seasons, why do it? But I think Mary's right. I think certainly you should be adopting South Korean dramas, and I'm sure people are looking at them. They wouldn't want to make it just a telenovela, a one-season affair, but they could adapt it and spin it out into a long-running drama. Ugly Betty, of course, is one of the best examples of a telenovela that transferred into the American market as a hit. That's, of course, not from South Korea, but it could work. I'm sure they're looking at them. I've never caught one. I wonder how you're watching them and how you get the subtitles, but that's fascinating. Do you stream it? Do you get DVDs? How are you doing that? But I bet you're right. I know K-pop. They're playing in Madison Square Garden. A group of South Korean pop stars are performing in New York sometime soon. I've got a DVD of K-pop stars that just came out on DVD a few weeks ago. And South Korean dramas are all over the world. certainly in the Asian market, and I'm sure it's only a matter of time before one of them gets adapted into a U.S. primetime hit.
Well, you know, I do know something you could stream, Michael.
What's that?
It's our podcast. You can stream it on our website, showbizsandbox.com, or you could download it at iTunes. I think the Zune Marketplace is still around, or maybe it's the Windows 8 store now. I don't know. Or you could listen to it on and download it on Stitcher.com. You know, we really do recommend, I don't know, whatever the right word there is, please subscribe to the show in either of those podcast aggregators. Anywhere they're giving away podcasts for free, you can subscribe to the show, iTunes, Zune Marketplace, or Stitcher. Or you can follow us. The way to follow us is on Twitter, at Showbiz Sandbox, or you can like our Facebook page, which is Showbiz Sandbox. In fact, showbizsandbox.com, again, is our website where you'll find ways to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's what Mary did. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. That information, along with links to all of these stories we just talked about on today's episode, can be found on showbizsandbox.com, again, our website. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found at a scuba store or an umbrella stand. And he also has a website where a lot of his work from the Huffington Post and other outlets can be found. It is
michaelgiltz.com.
Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week. Actually, not until next week. We will be taking a week off.
News to me.
Yes, I will be attending Show East in Miami, Florida, or Hollywood, Florida. Hopefully, Sandy, the hurricane will have passed by then. So until 2 weeks from now, play nice.